Going. Okay. Good evening, everyone. Good to see you. Lonnie, Gloria, Judd, Zadie, Henry, Paul. We got Mark, Phyllis. That's Erwin. And I think I might be doing the iPhone. Okay. Welcome, guys. We find ourselves on Chaf Ches Amud Beis 28B. A few logistical things to keep be aware of. One is, God willing, I'll send out an email, but we are aiming for Sunday morning, February 26th, for our CM, God willing. So please mark your calendars accordingly. Sunday morning, February 26th. I think we're going to call it for 9:30 a.m. And we'll have a brunch. And I think Alex and Marina kindly offered to go out and pick some stuff up if anyone else wants to be involved in the food process of this. Do let me know. It's clearly not my specialty. Mark your calendars. I'll send out more information as I have it. The second thing to think about is our next Masechta. There are. I'll try to narrow it down to two or three options for you guys. I know that there was an interest in Choshei Mishpat, some financial sugyos. So, if we want to do Dinei Mavnos, we want to do financial matters. We also are at the same time trying to make sure we could actually finish the Gemara in less than 5 years. So, I think that kind of knocks out Bava Kamma, Bava Metzia, and Bava Basra, which would have been the most intuitive choices for that. But I was thinking possibly of Sukkah. Because Sukkah has, of course, Lulav HaGazel right in the middle, which deals with the laws of stealing Lulav and the idea of theft, the idea of kinyanim and acquisitions and how that works. What's Sukkah? It's about 52, 53, something. It's somewhere in the 50s over there. I forget precisely how many. So it's a little bit longer than what we've been doing until now, which is around more 30 blot. But that is an option. Another option, by the way, is potentially Moed Katan. Toward the beginning, you're not going to have it as much, but Moed Katan, a little bit later on, will deal with laws of mourning and avelos. I know the Mishnah folks know that. Also, within the Gemara, it talks about laws of excommunication. So there's some interesting applications there as well. Those are two that I'm thinking. There's Titus also. I'm personally not feeling Titus as much, but those are some that I'm thinking of. If any of you have a suggestion, do send it to me. And I hope to send out some options for you to review. Okay. Anyway,
How about like Kedushin?
Kiddushin is great. It's super long. What is it? I think it's in the 90s, or someone could confirm that if that's correct. We could do Kiddushin in theory. I hope I'm retained long enough that we'll make it through all of Kiddushin together. But we'll figure that out. I mean, the other options to do is a perek in a mesechta, but you don't get the same gratification of completing an entire mesechta. But yes, that is an option as well. So anyway, I'm just putting it out there for you to start percolating, start thinking about it, and God willing, I'll send out an email and we'll get a vote in. All right. Okay. Here we go. We are on Chav Ches Amud Beis. We are on 28B. We find ourselves actually about a quarter way down. We did pretty well last week. So we're already about a quarter way down the Amud. We're up to Amar Rav Asi. We're going to be talking about the Bate Knesios Sheva Bavel, the synagogues of Babylon. Okay. We're going to kick it off with a really important Gemara, and we may just jump straight into Tosos. Amar Rav Asi. The synagogues of Babylonia, they were made with a stipulation that they could be used for other purposes. Nonetheless, even though they could be used for other purposes, one may not use it for activities that are, again, what's Kalas Rosh? Kalas Rosh, again, we translate, I think, Paul, you brought this up last time, as frivolous. Yet we also see that Kalas Rosh can, Tosos points out, refer to something like planting. Planting a field there would also be considered a Kalas Rosh. So something not to say frivolous, but something that is degrading and unbecoming for it. So it doesn't have to be like the worst thing you could possibly think of. But Why do I have to give you more examples? The Gemara itself gives an example. Umay nihu, cheshbonos. And what's an example? Cheshbonos, doing accounting. Accounting is done in the office. It's not done in shul. Now there are exceptions. Some shuls, they will do, what do you call it? Auctioning, right? The Zaidi, remember, remember back in the days during the high holidays at Young Israel? So the highlight of the high holidays was not so much the rabbi's sermon, it was the president's auctioning off. It was always funny, you know, sitting in the crowd and seeing like, you know, one guy say, oh, I'm going to take, you know. And then there's also like, there was always one kippah that was always given to the rabbi no matter what. And people would pay to give the rabbi the kavod that he was going to get anyway in the end of the day. So I guess it's just like, how much do you want to ingratiate yourself with the rabbi was the question. So, okay.
I didn't like the auctions.
You know, okay. Well, as a kid, I always found it entertaining. So, you know, you're going through a very you're going through high holiday service. But yes, possibly as an adult, maybe I would say it's Kalas Rosh. I don't know.
I mean, it's commercialization.
Well, that's actually what we're talking about. Part two on Shabbos, we're going to be talking about hiring people to say Kaddish and outsourcing things in terms of schar. So that'll be the 10:30 shiur, part two of the Shabbos. And that's one of the claims that some Rabbi Slifkin or Betzinu Zeal, others make against paying people to say Kaddish, is that it might commercialize a mitzvah. But we'll save it for that. Okay. Amar Rav Asi, Beisak Nesesh Mechashbo Cheshbos, Malinim Bo Es Hames. A shul in which they actually do accounting in it, they will lie a dead body in it. So the Gemara asks, Malinim Sakadaita Flo Sagi De La Afachi. Why do I need to have a deceased body inside the shul because of this? He wasn't saying you have to as a halachic obligation. He was saying it's a curse. El sof shealina bo meis mitzvah. And the end of the day, you're going to walk into shul one day. You're going to find a body. You're going to have to bury. So it's pretty dark. Apparently, for not treating the base hakneses with proper kavod. Now,
wouldn't that be giving kavod to the deceased?
Well. So we're going to talk about actually a little bit later, in the Gemara, not so later, but soon, we're going to be talking about giving eulogies in the Beis HaKnesses. But here, I think it's a curse. Like, you're just, imagine you come into shul for Shachar, 6:30 in the morning, and all of a sudden, God forbid, there's a dead body right there. That's I think, what he's saying. I don't think he's saying.
I'd have to turn around and walk out. I'm a Kohen.
Well, yes. Yeah, right. That's true. You would walk out of the building because you're a Kohen. Also true. Okay, so before going further in the Gemara, there is a really essential Tosfos that I want to bring your attention to. This is the first Tosfos on the blot. We're actually going to be doing a lot of things. I don't know if you're like me and you have the Oz HaHadar edition of the Gemara, but a lot of things we're going to quote right now are actually found in there. So you don't even need to go anywhere fancy. The Tosfos tells us, what kind of shuls can you stipulate that they may be used for purposes other than prayer? Tosfos actually, now I would think anything, right? Tosfos gives us two qualifications. Number one, Rotza Lomar, Kol Zaman Shehein Batalin, so long as they are no longer in use. Tosfos actually cites a proof from the Gemara we're going to see in a moment. The Gemara is going to tell us about how there were rabbis who didn't want to go into the shul unnecessarily to protect themselves from the rain. Wait, why couldn't they go into the shul if it was stipulated that such a shul can be used for alternative purposes? Must be because it didn't check off two boxes. Number one, the shul was still in operation. Number two, Tosfos tells us, and only for the synagogues in Bavel, which refers to diaspora in general. Now listen, what's the rationale? Why would I think that I could stipulate that a shul in the diaspora can be used for alternative purposes, whereas a shul in Eretz Yisrael cannot be used for alternative purposes, even though they're both out of operation? So what does Tosfos tell us?
It's temporary.
Oh, is that?
It's just temporary in
Chutzlar. Very good. So Henry tells us, Tosfos elucidates this, because when the Redeemer comes and we all move to Eretz Yisrael when the Messiah comes, what's going to happen? All of our shuls will lose their kedusha. Whereas the synagogues of Israel, their sanctity is eternal. Therefore, what's Tosfos telling us? Since the shuls in America, as much as we love them, since one day we're supposed to, in the time of the Messianic period, all move to Eretz Yisrael, maybe before Messianic period, depending if you're so inclined. Since it's no longer an operation right now, and it's not going to be an operation in the end of days either, it no longer has that same Kedusha. And therefore, if you stipulate it could be used for other purposes, then if it's not an operation anymore, it may indeed be used for other purposes. What is the issue with this, with the Tosos here? Paul, what are you going to tell us?
No, I was going to ask a question, so you go first.
Oh, no, I have a question also. Maybe it's the same question.
So my question is, can you cure the violation, the averus? Let's say you walk into the shul, it hasn't been, check off boxes have not been checked to get out of the rain. You go, oh my God, I shouldn't have done this. While I'm here, I'll daven mincha. Can you cure the error?
Very good question, Paul. And this is precisely what the Gemara is also troubled by. The Gemara is actually talking about you walked in and now you don't know what to do. But actually, even lechatchila, let's say the Gemara is going to have a case. You want to your buddy is in the base medrash, and you know you're trying to get them to come to a meal already. Like, we're going out for lunch. Come on. So can you enter into the shul just to grab your buddy? So the Gemara is going to suggest, similar to what you said, maybe if you read a pasuk or you teach or you learn some Torah while you're in there, maybe that will be sufficient. So very good. We'll get there in a moment. But just back to Tosa's point. What's the issue with Tosa's assumption? Tosa's saying is there, because the shuls in America are going to lose their kedusha in the end of days, therefore they could be used for other purposes. I got one problem with that, as we're going to learn soon. So the Korban Asali cites the mugging Abraham, who asks as follows: Tabisavach Amrin Asidikol Bati Knesset Shabbat Shei Yikvu Baris Israel. The Gemara is going to teach us that in the end of days, all the synagogues in the diaspora are going to magically be transported to the land of Israel. If that is true, then Tosa's whole premise falls away. Tosa's saying is the shuls in America, when they're abandoned, they're no longer used. You can use it for other purposes because they're never going to be reinstated with Kedusha in the end of days. But we have an Agadata, which tells us that no, actually the shuls of America, the shuls of the world, will be transported to Eretz Yisrael in the end of days, and they will reconstitute their Kedusha there. So how can Tosfos tell us the opposite? That's what the Magen Avraham asks. Now, what the answer that he offers is that Tosfos koi achor banan dekeimet shechar v'konami yisagot lo yikvu Eretz Yisrael. Tell us something very harrowing. If there's a shul that goes out of operation and they close it down, that shul will not make it to Eretz Yisrael in the end of days. Only the shuls that are still kept in operation in Galus will be eventually transferred to Eretz Yisrael. However, that's the Magen Avraham. The Korban Asanel is a commentary on the Rush, by the way. So the Korban Asanel asks, he questions the Magen Avraham's answer. He says, Akasha, to Mikol Makom, Nechlo Shema Yibane Kodem Biesa Goel, Kitzka Amar, Alubo Asavim, Lo Yitlosh Me Agmas Nevesh, Unu Leif Liv Nosa. Remember, we learned last week that if a shul is out of operation and the grass begins to grow, you're now out of cut it, so that you will say, Oy, vavoy, look at the grass growing, it's terrible. Why is the shul not being maintained? You're like, oh, wait, because no one's using the shul. So then you'll say, oh, maybe we should be using the shul again, and we should have put it back into proper operation. So if so, how can we use even a dilapidated, inoperable shul in the diaspora if we actually have an imperative that Chazal wants us to see these shuls and rebuild them even before Mashiach comes? So what kind of answer? So again, you know, Hadar Kushal Adukhta, we're back to the same place. These shuls are going to have some Kedusha in the end of days, or we hope they will. So interestingly, the Carmen Asano distinguishes his answer as Belinira de Lokomer Elish Yikluber Tisrao, Tainua Karka, Bahem Kedushas Besak Nessus, Rakidushas Eretz Yisrael. He basically distinguishes between the building of the shul and the land that the shul sits on. The building, the bricks and mortar won't be transferred, but the karka, the land, will be transferred to Eretz Yisrael in the end of days. That is to say, as far as the building is concerned, one would be permitted to use the building when it is outside of Israel and they stipulate it could be used for other purposes when it's no longer in operation. Okay, so that's the whole carbon nisano over there. Anyway, halacha lemaisa. If you look at the Mishnah Berurah, who actually, I believe, quotes that Magen Avraham that we cited just before, and actually, the term Bavel in the Gemara is a red herring. It's not about the synagogues of Bavel versus the synagogues of Israel. It's not about whether they're in operation or not in operation. So long as you build a shul and you stipulate that it could be used for alternative purposes, provided they are not unbecoming purposes for a Beis HaKnesses, there's no Kalas Rosh, then they may be used. What's an example? Such as, let's say there are people in town, they don't have anywhere to eat, and you set up, you know, now we have a beautiful edifice in our community. The typical shul back in the day, like look at the old schoolhouses, for instance, or the chapels, right? They're just one big room. That's it. So the shuls also were like that. It was just one big room. They couldn't go to the social hall for the meals. So it'd be permissible to have a meal, a Shabbos student for those who need it inside the shul. Which, by the way, the whole sugya, the whole discussion about in Arvi Pesachim, we talk about Kiddush b'makom suda. You have to make Kiddush where you eat it. So they make Kiddush in shul on Friday night for those who are eating in the shul in that very same room. So, okay. That was, Tosas, that was a little bit of a rabbit hole. I know we just went down, but I couldn't resist. Any rate, back into the text of the Gemara. Hopefully we got to rest our eyes, and now we can look in. Here we go. All right, we learned, this is quoting from the Braisa before, B'enei osin behen. So he said that it's unclear precisely what it means, but you're not supposed to basically groom yourself inside the Beis HaKnesses. Amarava chachayu tamidehem mutarin. However, those who are Torah scholars are allowed to groom themselves in a Beis Medrash. Why? So Darishan ben Lakish, my Bei Rabbanan, Beisa de Rabbanan. Ah, so what is the distinction here? What is a Beis Medrash called in rabbinic parlance? It's sometimes referred to as a Bei Rabbanan, which means a Beis de Rabbanan, a house of the rabbis. In other words, this is basically the Beis Medrash we talked about last week is where the rabbis live. They spend a lot of their days there studying Torah. They spend more time there than they probably, much more time there than they spend in their actual houses. Some people who's, some of you guys I know are lawyers or medical or different things that your work requires you to live in your offices also. So you get what that's like. Therefore, for them, they're allowed to do even groom themselves in there if they need to, because that's basically their home away from home. So that's a special. It's not that a Beis Medrash has less kedusha than a Beis HaKnesses. We actually established in a previous year that a Beis Medrash has more kedusha than a Beis HaKnesses. A Beis HaKnesses can be turned to a Beis Medrash, but not vice versa. Why is it that there's a dispensation for a Beis Medrash? It's because it's the home of the rabbis. So the rabbis have, or the yeshiva bachrim, have a dispensation to do certain things there that they would do in their own homes. Okay, next. We also stated earlier in the Braisa that one may not go into a Beis HaKnesses in order to shield themselves from the sun or from the rain. So here we go. Kihad Rabina Rav Ada Bar Masna have Kayam Yushai Shilta Me Rava. So Rav Ada Bar Masna and Rabina, they were asking questions in Torah from Rava. Also Zilcha de Mitra. What happened was it began to pour. I in the Beit Kedishna, so they went to the, inside the Beis HaKnesses. to shield themselves from the rain. Amri, hai da'alin lebech nishta, la mishum mitra, el mishum dishmaisa, bad silusa kimo da'asinsa. What's the reason that we went into I'm just going to mute this noise coming from somewhere. Okay, found it. So the question the Gemara is asking is, wait, how could they go inside the shul if you're not supposed to go into a shul for shelter? So the answer is, they went in the shul because in order to have an intense Torah discussion, that requires clarity of mind. So you're not going to have clarity of mind if you're standing out in the rain. So it's not that they went into the shul to protect themselves from the rain. They went into the shul in order so they could study with clarity of mind by protecting themselves from the rain. So it was for the purpose of studying Torah that they were able to go in. Which leads us to Paul's question about going into a shul and perhaps doing something of a Torah nature that might let us in. If you need to grab somebody from shul and you're not currently in there, my, so in what way might it be permissible to do that? So if you are a Torah scholar, learn a halacha when you're there. If you are don't really know Gemara so well, but you know Mishnayos, recite a Mishnah. Just one moment. And if you only know to read Mikra, to read Torah, read a Pasuk. And if you don't know how to read Pesukim, ask one of the kids studying there, can you teach me a Pasuk that you're reading today? And finally, if none of those work, or you don't want to bother that kid studying, inami nishi porta v'nekum. Just sit in the base Manderson, the base Akhnesis for a little bit, let some time pass, and then go and find your friend. Why is that helpful? So clearly there's a value to spending time simply in the house of God. And even if you are not able to study Torah there, simply by soaking in the environment, it could have an indelible effect on someone. And of course, we discussed that when we talked about bringing children to shul, that there's a value to being inside the Beis HaKnesses, even if one is not capable of studying the Torah.
Okay. I've experienced the reverse situation. We're in shul on Shabbos, for example, and we've finished Mechamayrav, and it's time to go home. And we get to the door, and there is a downpour. Can you stay in the shul while you wait for the rain to abate?
Yeah, good question. I would imagine there's no isser to stay in the shul if you're already there. The isser would seem to be going in, but I think remaining in the shul would not be problematic. But let's say, you know, for instance, you go out and then you come back in once you see the weather, to read Ashrei or something, Pasuk, something, just to justify you being there, hopefully is not too much of a imposition. Phyllis, you had a question?
Yeah. I just wanted to clarify the reason why the Beis Medrash has a higher level of Kedusha is because it's the place where Torah is studied, not necessarily the rabbis, although maybe they call it that.
Higher level is because of the Torah study. But the question is, why is it that, you know, that certain people are allowed to eat and drink in the Beis Medrash, whereas they can't in the Beis HaKnesses? So the answer is, it's for Talmidei Chachamim, who are basically living in the Beis Medrash. Yes. So that's why they can do it. Yeah.
Yes, and what about the rules? Let's say you want to go into a Beis Medrash, like you just discussed going into a Beit HaKnesses. So what do you do there to make it okay?
I believe it's the same. Yeah, I think it's the same thing. I think it's interesting. You know, there are certain parts of the Gemara here that kind of group Beis Medrash and Beis HaKnesses together. And then there's certain things where the Gemara is, specifically referring, let's say, to Beis Medrash. So Yeah, it's important to distinguish. All right, Shlaya. Let's go further, and we will now talk about eulogies. Sounds like a lot of fun, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Masvida Behenreg, as we were talking about Moed Katan before, about Hilchos Avelos and laws of mourning. So if you're interested in that, you'll be interested in this. Masvida Behen Hesped Shal Rabim. As we said, in general, a Beis HaKnesses may not be utilized for a eulogy unless it is of the masses. The way we interpret that earlier is that if you have, let's say, a Gadol Hador, or you have some great Talmid Chacham, a great rabbi, whom the entire community is mourning, and they need to make use of that shul for it, then it's appropriate, but not for the standard individual. So, Eri Dami, Hespeda Deravim, what would be an example of a Hesped that the entire community comes together for? So, Mechav Yerachista could go Hespeda the Kaye Bei Rav Sheshes. So Rav Chista and Rav Sheshes both point at each other and they say a hesped for your family would be considered a hesped for the entire community. He says no, a hesped of your family would be considered a mourning for the entire community and would necessitate that. Okay, next. Rafram Esped Lechalose Bebei Kenishta. So Rafram had to eulogize daughter-in-law in the shul. Now, how did he justify that? She wasn't a Torah scholar. So, Amar Mishum Yikara Didi Udemisa Azukuleyama. For my honor and for the deceased's honor, everyone is coming out. So, when you put the both of us together, it is justified. Similarly, Rabbi Zera Safde Luhumir Abanove Knishta. Rabbi Zera eulogized one of the rabbis in the shul. And he also said, Amar Imishum Yikara Didi, Imishum Yikara Didi. Whether it's because of my kavod, whether it's because of the deceased rabbi's kavod, they're clearly coming out in the masses for these for this purpose, and therefore, again, it's justified to use the Beis HaKnesses. Now, just kind of
why did he have to mention him? Why do they have to mention him? Wasn't it good enough that the person who died was a gadol?
So it's unclear to me when he says Allahumir Rabbanan to what degree like this particular rabbi, you know, what his I don't want to do like rabbi rankings, but I'm not sure if he was like necessarily qualified for the same level on the totem pole as Rabbi Zera. It's unclear to me. You know, we don't even get the person's name. So just think about that for a moment. So you know it's but again, it's always hard to make rabbi hierarchies. You know, when I was a kid, we had the rabbi cards that we give out at school and you behave, you get a rabbi card or a rabbi sticker. I always wanted to put like stats on them, you know, like after the sports cards or Magic the Gathering. And, you know, what are like the top tier, what do they call like this conference and that conference? So it'd be very entertaining if someone put in all that time. I'm not putting in all that time, but it'd be a really good partner stick. Okay. On a related note about eulogies, Reish Lakish Safti Lutzurim Rabbanon, the Shkiah Ba'arad Yisrael, Davitani Hilchusta Bechavda Shurasa. So Reish Lakish eulogized this Torah scholar who would normally be making his rounds in Israel. He didn't seem to live. It's kind of the opposite. You know, it's funny. Usually we have the people from Mizrahi who try coming to America to speak at the American shuls. But I guess there was like reverse movement to bring American scholars to Israel to teach there. Sign me up if there's an organization that does that. So Amar, oi oi chesra arad Yisrael gavaraba. So he eulogized him and he said, woe to the land of Israel, we've lost a great man. So he clearly, that's a high compliment because the guy didn't even live in Israel, yet he's saying the land of Israel has lost a great man. Contrast this with the following anecdote. Ahu dahavi tani hilchus Sifra, Sifrei, Tosepta, Ushachin, so there was this person who he knew the Sifra, he knew the Sifrei, he knew the Tanayim's commentaries on Vayikra through Devarim. So, and he knew the Tosepta, the collection of Brises as well, and he passed away. So clearly he knew a lot of stuff. And so, Va'amr later, Rav Nachman, listen to Beimar. They asked him, can you eulogize this person who clearly had collected a lot of Torah knowledge in his mind? Amar hechi nasvidei, hai son of the Moli Sifrei the Chaser. How can I eulogize such a person who is like a basket that's full of svarim, that's like an empty basket full of svarim? What does that mean? He was basically saying that this guy, I think Rashi explains, the ein maven ma besocha avshona alachas l'shimish tamachachon l'tamach shivnu tami mishnah. He soaked in a lot of data, but he didn't know how to analyze the data. So he had good memorizing skills, but not good analytical skills. He didn't spend time studying under a Talmud Chacham. He kind of just, you know, took out an English Mishnayos and read it through and had a amazing memory. So he remembered all the Mishnayos by, or not Mishnayos, but he knew the Tosefta, let's say, by heart. But he didn't really know how to make comparisons between different laws. He didn't know how to, when a Mishnah needs to be read in a certain way, or you need to read between the lines. So therefore, Rav Chisda, sorry, Rav Nachman did not feel that he was worthy of such a eulogy. So the Gemara concludes, Tachazi ma bein takifei da'ar di solach hasid ababel. We get to contrast now Reish Lakish's attitude to Rav Nachman's attitude. Rav Nachman was very hesitant to eulogize such an individual, whereas Reish Lakish said, this guy isn't even, he could have just said, this guy doesn't even live in Eretz Yisrael. Why should I bother eulogizing him? Yet he delivered a eulogy for him nonetheless. Okay. That's the end of the discussion about eulogies, but on the topic about honoring Talmidei Chachamim, we're now going to bring in a Mishnah from Pirkei Avos. Next section.
Moshe? As far as the bringing a Torah scholar from the United States to Israel, I've been taught.
I want a free ticket to Israel. That's all I was saying.
Yeah. Pardon?
Nothing.
I've been taught that after the Holocaust, until after the death of Rabbi Feinstein, Torah scholarship was centered in the United States, and Torah scholars in Israel didn't achieve preeminence until after that point in time. So you could have brought, let's say, Rabbi Feinstein to Israel to teach. And he was the leading scholar at that time.
Well, you know, they had their fair share of scholars in Israel as well. I mean, you know, you had Chaim Avadi Yosef and others. But I guess this gets back to the point. I'm not sure how to do Gadol rankings. But certainly, I'm sure the people living in Israel would have benefited from learning from Rav Moshe Feinstein. It's very interesting, by the way, the primacy that Rav Moshe enjoys in American Judaism. To many Israelis, Rav Moshe is a gadol, but many times, let's say we're having a halachic discussion, and I find an Igros Moshe that agrees with me, I can pull that out as my trump card. And, you know, I say, like, good luck arguing with Rav Moshe Feinstein on it. You know, like that, you could basically, if you have Rav Moshe on your side for anything, you might not be able to convince the other side, but at least you can convince them that you're in very good company. In Israel, like, Rav Moshe is not the final word necessarily on many issues. Part of it is because he was in America, part of it is because he's Ashkenazi, and a lot of Israeli society is more Sephardic oriented. But even, like, you know, here's a good example. Listen, Chanal Frisch reached out to me. He's in his Israeli living here with his family. His wife's at Yale right now. So in our community. So I posted on Asar B'Teves a little bit of a joke and a criticism that when you go on My Zmanim website, right? That's the website you look at to see when the fast begins and ends, and among other things. So it says, according to Moshe Feinstein, the fast ends at X time. And if you can't handle it, then at X time. And then there's a guy beforehand. You guys remember his name?
Rav Tuchinsky.
Rav Tuchinsky, right. So Rav Tuchinsky, many people don't realize, like a lot of people in America, like who don't really realize who Rav Tuchinsky is, it's like, oh, it must be some like random pulpit rabbi who had it in with Mayas Manim and they put his name on it.
No.
But then you realize Rav Tuchinsky is actually like one of the authorities on Zmanim in general. He has the entire book on it. And if you ever do the Halakhic Dateline Sugya, Yeah. Which is a very complicated one. Like, yeah. He's one of the main shitos on Halachic Dateline. So, yeah.
Yep.
Also, he is the author of one of the definitive works on Hilchos Avelos, the Gesher HaChayim, that we cited a number of times in our Shir on Kaddish. So, Rav Tikhachinsky actually enjoys a lot more influence in Israel, and they follow him much more in Israel. But in America, since a lot of people don't know who he is, they're like, I've heard of Rabbi Feinstein. I don't know who Rav Tikhachinsky is. So it's a little bit of a shame. So one of my friends responded. He messaged me. He's like, if you want to rely on ending the fast as early as Rav Tikhachinsky says, you have to be able to name two psukim of Rav Tikhachinsky.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
I find it a bit disturbing that they nickel and dime Talmidei Chachamim in order to decide whether they want to eulogize them or not. I mean, who are they to decide who is the higher up Talmud Chacham? I mean, there's something about that doesn't ring well with me.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think there's a part one thing to say is that was kind of a point that Gemara was making, was that Rav Nachman was very resonant about going ahead and giving a eulogy for someone he didn't really know, whereas Reish Lakish was amenable to doing that. But another point to be made also is that, you know, someone like me, you know, Moshe Kurtz doesn't have a chance of figuring out who's the bigger gadol. But if you go to people who we know are actually gadolim, they generally can figure it out amongst themselves. So I leave it to them to worry about. And Paul.
There seems to be something political going on in this last discussion. What am I missing?
It's something political.
Between Bavel and Israel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
The interesting part is that if there was going to be something political, it would have been coming from Reish Lakish. Because Reish Lakish could have been the one to say, this guy doesn't even live in Israel. Why should I bother eulogizing him? Yet we say Reish Lakish was the one who was amenable to eulogizing him. Ironically, Rav Nachman, who takes the is simply saying that the person just wasn't worthy of it based on his own rabbinic credentials, that it was kind of below Rav Nachman's office to be eulogizing someone who never even did shemush and didn't study under a Talmud Chacham.
Right, but the way this section ends, it says it very clearly. Come and see the difference between the haughty scholars of Eretz Israel and the pious scholars of Babylon. I mean, that's pretty political.
Yeah, exactly.
So who made that statement? Just, you know, whoever writes the Gemara? I mean, there's no attribution to that statement.
Well, that's the editors of the Gemara. And for those who have more studies in academic Talmud, can kind of figure out at what generation certain things were put in. We do have a citation. There's a similar statement that comes up in Tainus and Chaf Gimel Amud Beis and Chul and Kuf Chaf Beis Amud Aleph. So, right, this isn't the first time. There's other times in the Talmud where we see similar statements being made that gives preference to Eretz Yisrael over Babylon. No surprise.
Okay. No, this is the other way. I mean, the Babylon is better. The pious scholars of Babylon as opposed to the haughty scholars of Eretz Yisrael. It seems to me to be saying that the writers of the Talmud Bavli are better than the writers of the Talmud Yerushalmi.
Well, smarter. Yeah.
Shouldn't come as a surprise considering we're reading the Bavli.
Right, exactly.
But I think there's alternative translations for takife. I don't know if haughty is what our scroll says.
Mm.
It says haughty.
Body, yeah. Interesting. I think there were, I didn't look too carefully into it. I think there were other translations that didn't translate it as negatively.
Steinzahl's uses the term harsh.
Mine says Sonnet Tokef, right?
Aloof.
Wow, these are all interesting. So, like, you know, think about like the word like Nisana Tokef. I'll relate over the intensity of the day. So there's different ways to read it, whether it's, you know, okay. But point well taken. Okay, let's make sure we get in the rest of the Gemara for today. We still got what to cover, guys. Here we go. It's not Hasam. We're bringing some Pirkei Avos, right? How often do we cite Pirkei Avos? Anyone who utilizes the crown of Torah will be taken out of this world. Tani, Reish Lakish, Tani Reish Lakish, Zeh HaMishtamish B'Mish Shona HaLakos. So this refers to someone who teaches or learns halachos, who learns the Gemara. So such a person, if someone makes use of them, then they will be removed from this world. So it's interesting. When you look in the Mishnah is also saying, don't make the Torah as a card or lach barbo. You shouldn't be utilizing the Torah for your own ends. So the standard reading of the Mishnah, as I recall, is that telling Talmidei Chachamim, it's warning the rabbis not to make use of their station, not to utilize all those benefits that might come along with it. Now, the reading the Gemara here is giving of the Mishnah is that not just a warning to rabbis not to misuse the benefits of the rabbinate, but it's also giving a warning to people who want to misuse the rabbis for their own purposes. See the bias here as well, right? So Amar Ula, the Shamish finished Ramad to Tani Arba, Velo Shamish Ramad to Masni Arba. So Ula distinguishes between being Tani teaching. So basically, right? So we got Zra Moed, Nashim Nizik, and Kashin Taharos. Those are six Siddarim. So Zrayim is not really so relevant if you're not Eretz Yisrael, right? Remember, as Toby pointed out, this is the Talmud Bavli. So many of the laws of Zrayim, which are agricultural laws pertaining to Israel, not as heavily studied. Hence, all we have is brachos. We don't have a Talmud Bavli on the rest of Zrayim. And same thing for Taharos. Taharos, a lot of these laws without the Beis HaMikdash really aren't relevant. So we're really just talking about Moed, Nashim, Nezikin, and Kachim are the four volumes that are significantly studied. We study Kachim because it talks about the offerings that are brought. So we pray to God that our study of the Karbanos will be in lieu of bringing the Karbanos. Okay, so now the question is, what is the Tani and the Masni? So one distinction is Mishnayos versus Gemara, or it could be meaning learning versus teaching. Okay, those are two different ways to understand what the distinction is. Either it's talking about someone who only knows Mishnayos, you don't have to worry about making use of them. Someone who knows Gemara, you better not start asking for favors from them. Don't ask them to do clerical work for you. Or it's talking about the distinction is someone who learns Torah versus someone who teaches Torah. You have to, I know this is a little bit counterintuitive, like today, just because you teach Torah doesn't mean you necessarily know a lot of Torah. But apparently, at least back then, if you want to be a teacher of Torah, it also indicated that you knew a lot of Torah as well. Okay. So Ula doesn't make a blanket statement. He distinguishes between different tiers of Talmidei Chachamim. And we're going to bring in a story right now, which would seem to prove this point. So when Reish Lakish was going along the way, Mata Urukma Demaya, he got to this body of water, this lake. Also, Gavra Arkave Akafse, came along this man and he puts him on his shoulders. And he was going to help get him across this little body of water. So Reish Lakish asked him, do you read anything good? Read any Torah? You read the good book? Amarle, Karina, yeah, I read the good book. Tanisa, Tanina, Arba Sidrei Mishnah. Do you learn Mishnayas? He says, yep, I've gone through all the four volumes that I need to know. All the four Siddharim. Amarle, Pesavlacha, Arba, Turi, Tata, Bar Lakish, Akasvech, Shadi Bar Lisha, Sabamaya. So, wait a minute, you're telling me that you know all this Mishnayas? And you're carrying me? Throw me into the water. I can't make use of your services. You're clearly a Talmud Chacham of some sort. So Amar Leh, no, Nichli Gashmi Lamar. Raj explains what that means. I want to help you. It's okay. I want to serve you anyway. There's a side question here about being Mochel, a Talmud Chacham, that's being Mochel, quoto, if you can forgo your honor, but we'll leave that for another time. So Reish Lakish concedes He says, Ihachi, Gomorini Hamilsa, let me teach you something so that I can become like your Rebbe, and therefore that way it'll be permissible for you to carry me and help me. So what does he teach him? He teaches him a very important law in Hilchos Nida. I'll explain what the law is in just a moment, but let me just explain what the point of the story is. The point of the story is that we see there's a distinction between those who study Mishnayos versus those who study Gemara, or possibly what it's actually telling us is a distinction between someone who only studies versus someone who teaches. And once Reish Lakish became the teacher, so then it was permissible for Reish Lakish to make use of his service. Anyway, this story is basically informing us of a practical application of not making use of a Talmud Chacham for mundane purposes. There's definitely a lot of commentary about the modern rabbinate, but I'm not going to talk about that here. Okay. So there is, I don't even know how to give background on this. Do you guys want to understand this halakha and Hilchos Nida? I'll try to summarize it very quickly. I'll say first why he's teaching. And one reason that he might be teaching is because many times in Jewish law, as you know, there's machlokis about the minutia of everything. So what Reish Lakish wanted to do is he wanted to teach him something definitive that everyone agrees on. So he teaches him, this is actually known later, it's attributed, I think Reish Lakish is before Rabbi Zeira, so, but it gets attributed to Rabbi Zeira. It's called Chumer to Rabbi Zeira. So basically, this is the bottom line. I'll try to summarize it. There's a nice long Rashi here as well. On a biblical level, there's something called a Zava and something called a Nida. Nida is a woman menstruates, normal time. So then she waits 7 days. If she menstruates during those days, that's fine. So long as at the end of the 7 days, she ceases to menstruate, she does a Hefsek Tahara, she does Hefsek Tahara, and that's it. And then she goes to Mikvah, done. So the thing is, what if she continues to see blood into the 11 days afterwards? So then if she sees blood 3 days in a row, she becomes what's called a Zava Gedola. And the Zava Gedola, after seeing 3 days of blood, when she's not supposed to be seeing the blood, so then she has to wait what's called Shiva Nikiyim, not just a 7 day waiting period, but she cannot see any blood during the 7 day period. And if she sees blood, she has to start the count all over again. And what happened was women were it's very confusing, by the way. When I went through Hilchos Nida, my mind still spins. Thankfully, they have apps nowadays that you could pay for that actually help calculate this for you. But they didn't have those helpful apps on your phone back then that could calculate the days for you. And so women weren't sure when they were in the 7 days that were normal sea blood, when they were in the 11 days that we consider a Zava. So the women themselves took upon themselves and said, right, look at the language here. It's fascinating. Generally, in Judaism, we're used to the rabbis legislating from on high. Here, it was a grassroots movement, but you know, it wasn't a grassroots movement to move away from the Torah. It was a grassroots movement to be more machmir and to strengthen the observance of Torah, right? That's what we want to be seeing. The Benos Yisrael Hinechnira Atzman. The women got together and they took the chumra upon themselves. Shapu rose tipas dam kecharal yoshtov shem nekiyim. That even if they think that they're really just a nida, they're going to observe it as if they're a zava gedola, which means that they will have to wait shiva nekiyim. So that's why women have to, and they do. Women now do multiple zahef. So nowadays, like one thing piled on top of the other, and if you're Ashkenazi, you have 5 days, and then after you do a Hefsek Tahara, and then you have multiple medikos, depending on what she does. So then at the end, so basically after 12 days, then you finally, a woman finally goes to mikvah. So anyway, there's layers upon layers upon layers over here. But the point being is that he taught him a halakha that basically everyone signs on to. That way he knew he actually taught him something that was acceptable. All right. We are not doing Nidah as our next Masechta. Because, you know, the funny thing is people say, like, oh, let's learn Maseches Nidah, learn Hilchos Nidah. Well, and then you realize that there's like a lot about, you know, because what people don't realize is that there's really two main applications of being a Nidah. One is vis-a-vis marital relations. The other is vis-a-vis Tumah and Tahara. So, you know, we said we're not, Tumah and Tahara doesn't really apply nowadays vis-a-vis the Beis HaMikdash and other laws. So we only think about it in the marital context. But there was a whole other side to things about women being Tameh and, you know, all the laws of Tumah Tahara that go along with it, which comes up in Nidah that people don't realize. Okay. So also it's pretty long. Moving forward. Final things for this evening. We only got a few minutes left, so let me make sure we could get this in. This is something we you're probably very familiar with.
Yeah.
They add in that it's actually missing the gears here, but every day. Anyone who learns halachos every day is guaranteed to be get membership until Olam.
You're cutting out. Hello.
Okay. The way. No one hears me.
You're cutting out.
Oh.
Hello.
Can you guys hear me now?
Yes.
I lost your voice.
Yeah.
Oh, has my voice returned?
Yes.
Okay, good. Going forward. So don't read as the ways, but as halachos, which might be the same shorish anyway. So anyone who learns halachos every day, they will have the world to come. Panoramanan. Final Bryce that we'll do for now. We cease to study Torah if there's a need to bury someone for a funeral or to help bring a woman to the bridal canopy. And indeed, the great sage Yehuda bar Eloi, he would desist from studying Torah in order to perform these two important mitzvos. Now, here's a qualification. We only say this if there isn't enough people that it's respectable. If there are enough people that it's respectable for the Talmud Chacham, so then one does not need to stop studying Torah. Now, the question is, how many do you need for it to be considered respectable? So we have a few opinions. I'm Rav Shmuel Bar Ina, Mishmei Derav. 12,000 men, and then 6,000 shofar blowers or trumpeteers. The Amrila Tracer Alfe Gavri Minaya Shisa Alfe Shipure. Some say 12,000 men, and among them 6,000 are trumpeteers. Ula Amar Kigo de Chaitzi Gavrimi Uvula Ad Sikra. Half the amount of men it takes from if you measure them. From the Rashi tells us from the Shar HaIr, from the gate of the city to the cemetery, the Beis HaKfaros. Rav Sheshes Amar, this is very poetic. Kinesinasa kach netilasa. The same way the Torah is given, so it is taken. Manesinasa b'shishim ribo, af netilasa b'sanach ribo. Just the Torah was given at Har Sinai with 60 myriads of people there, so too it is taken. With 60 myriads as well. Hani Mili, Lamada Karyutani. This refers to someone who reads the Torah and one who either just studies or is referring to someone who only knows Mishnayos. Alamada Masni, but one who either teaches or studies Gemara. Lasli Shiure, there is no upper limit. Everyone has to close their Gemaras and go out to the funeral. And indeed, I remember that in high school. We didn't really go on in Masifta, we didn't really go on field trips. But I think I've shared this with you that. I know it sounds really awful, but there was like kind of this really great rabbi, I don't even remember who it was, from Brooklyn, who passed away, and they said, all right, Rabbi Isai, we're getting on the school buses and we're going out, and we're like, wait, we're actually like going on a trip in high school? We never do that here. So regrettably, we were very excited, even though we were going to a funeral just to get out and have some fresh air. I think my friends and I, it was like all in Yiddish and we were all like on Ocean Parkway and no one knew what was flying. So at some point in the middle, we all just like said, oh, there's a pizza shop over there around the corner. So apparently we did not read the Gemara and we did not follow. Halacha is that there is no limit, upper limit, and the more people there, the better. Okay. So you get some fun anecdotes in there as well. All right. Shkoyach, everyone. Wishing you all a wonderful Shabbos. Again, please mark your calendars. Sunday morning, February 26th, God willing. And again, if anyone wants to help, I'm trying to figure out the food situation. I'm not sure we're going to maybe bring in some catering or not, but if anyone wants to help spearhead that, let me know. And I'll try to put together some good options for our next Masechta. I'll let you know some of the topics in there, the length of each one, and hopefully we could try to get to something of a consensus if possible. All right. Yeah. Good job, good. Everyone. Wish you all a wonderful evening.
Yeah. Yeah. Rabbi Kurtz, but by the way, I mentioned to Rabbi Rees that you already used the Sefer that he edited from Rav Schwartz. He said it gave him a lot of nachas that someone was already using the Sefer. So.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you for conveying that. Thank you.
All right. Have a good Shabbos, everybody.
Thank you.